Hello, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of Memo's Weekly Review with me, Nassim Ahmed, and our regular guest, Moin Rabbani. Hello, Moin. Thank you for joining us again.
Hi, Nassim, and as always, it's a pleasure to be with you again.
And as usual, we'll be analyzing key events from over the past week. And this week, we will be beginning with the latest development on the ICJ genocide case against Israel. And then we'll speak about a report on the Al Ahli Hospital bombing from October 17, 2023, which concludes that there's almost a mathematical certainty that it was Israel who was behind that attack. Not only that, the authors argue that that was a test case to see global response to Israel destroying Gaza's health sector. So we'll look at that as well. US troops begin construction of Biden's long-awaited pier. I want to get your thoughts on that, Moin, as well. And then also the Biden administration, along with other Western countries this week, they are working very hard to prevent an imminent arrest warrant against Benjamin Netanyahu's. I don't know what the likelihood of that is, but we'll look into that as well. And staying with the Biden administration, we'll speak about the US reversing the decision to sanction a religious extremist battalion in the West Bank. We touched on that last week, but I think we'll go into a bit more detail about that. And the protests that are spreading across the US universities against Israel's genocide. And we'll end with Elon Musk, who's using seems to be using his Twitter platform to amplify his support for Israel, and has been making some very clumsy statements regarding Israel and Palestine. So that will be right at the end. But let's begin with Moin, with the former head of the ICJ, Joan Donoghue. So she's resigned since from the ICJ as the president. She gave an interview recently to the BBC, and that interview has been jumped on by a number of pro-Israeli commentators to dismiss the claim that the ICJ has concluded that there is no plausible genocide in Gaza. That wasn't what she said. So I want to get your thoughts on exactly what she said, and should she have really come out and commented on that in the way she did?
Important question. Let me just start by saying we're anticipating a further development at the International Court of Justice, and that is the case that Nicaragua brought against Germany, also under the Genocide Convention, accusing it of aiding and abetting Israel's genocidal assault on the Palestinian people and the Gaza Strip, and calling on the court to impose provisional measures in Germany, chiefly relating to its weapons exports to Israel. And many people have wondered why Nicaragua raised its case against Germany rather than the more obvious candidate, which is the United States. And the reason for this appears to be that when it signed and ratified the Genocide Convention, the United States put in a clause that it could only be a party to any dispute under that convention on the basis of its prior consent. And it appears that the Nicaraguans decided that launching a case against the United States, therefore, wasn't an option. And they set their sights on the next best thing, in this case, Germany. But as you mentioned, and the court is expected, I think, in the coming week to issue its ruling on Nicaragua's request for provisional measures. But as you mentioned, the more visible, let's say, story regarding the court and genocide this week has been an interview that the outgoing or the former American judge on the court and the woman who was the president of the court at the time that it issued its initial provisional rulings in January, Judge Donoghue, she gave an interview to the BBC in which she made a technically correct statement that in the larger scheme of things amounts to a distinction without a difference. And I think also calls into question her judgment in doing so. What she said was that the court did not assess the question of whether Israel was plausibly guilty of committing genocide or not, for the simple reason that the court is not yet judging the merits of the case. What she then said is that what the court did do is that it determined that South Africa had plausibly demonstrated that Palestinian rights under the Genocide Convention are under real and imminent threat. I don't think I'm quoting her verbatim, but what it amounts to is, you know, the distinction between rights and claims. And, she made the point that that the threat to the Palestinians was real and that provisional measures were imposed because the court ruled that it was a matter of urgency. And I believe it was law professor Heidi Matthews who questioned the wisdom of a judge, even though in this case a former judge who was no longer on the bench, speaking publicly about a case that she was directly involved in, addressing what are essentially technical matters in a manner that not only sowed confusion for much of the public, but gave Israel and its apologists an opening to make the false claim that the court had basically dismissed South Africa's case. And Judge Donoghue said nothing of the sort. Again, when you take all their statements together, and if you're not addressing a specialized seminar in the international law of genocide, it's entirely appropriate to say that the court determined that South Africa had plausibly demonstrated that Israel was engaged in genocide, and therefore the court took the decision to proceed to a full hearing of the case in which it will judge whether Israel is actually guilty or not guilty of genocide, as opposed to dismissing it as the equivalent of a frivolous lawsuit. So I think it's very unfortunate that Judge Donoghue not only weighed into this question, but weighed into it in the manner that she did. Again, international legal specialists have noted that while her words were technically accurate, they had the effect of distorting how people will understand what the court actually did and did not decide. And that the points she made in the larger scheme of things amount to, again, a distinction without a difference. And if you examine the interview further, she also pointed out that Israel did not meet its obligations to the court in terms of the provisional measures that it ordered.
Yeah, and it seems to me when I listened to the interview that it was intended to sow confusion. What the pro-Israelis have not been reporting on is the last point you made, which is that Israel has not met any of the provisional measures. But if you ask many of the experts on genocide, there seems to be almost a consensus on the fact that Israel is committing genocide. And this week we saw a professor from the university, Hebrew University, Amos Goldberg, who is a Holocaust and genocide researcher. And I want to quote him verbatim from his article. He goes on, he says that, yes, it is genocide. It is so difficult and painful to admit it, But despite all that, and despite all our efforts to think otherwise, after 6 months of brutal war, we can no longer avoid this conclusion.
Yes.
So, I found it really compelling article, partly because he goes on to say that every single genocide, he cites a number of genocides, and nearly all the genocides that have been committed were committed on the basis that they were defending themselves against a threat, whether it be Rwanda, whether it be the genocide of Muslims in Bosnia, Myanmar. Every other example he cites suggests that the people committing the genocide carried out the genocide on the assumption or on the belief that they were under imminent threat or it was self-defense.
Yes, they had a genuine belief that they were engaged in self-defense of their state, of their civilization, of whatever. And that feeling was real. And it's also entirely irrelevant, as what he was. I thought it was a crucially important article, not only because of its substance, which you've just summarized, but also given the scholarly credentials of the author. And we should also state his identity. He is an Israeli Jewish Holocaust and genocide scholar. So, you know, he kind of checks all the boxes for someone who is more than authorized to speak on this issue. Again, and regarding Judge Donahue, you know, one can be, or former Judge Donahue, I guess, one can be cynical and say, well, the woman is out of a job. She not only participated in, but presided over a ruling that could be a career ender. You know, she needs to arrange either new professional gigs or speaking engagements. And this is kind of her mea culpa to make sure that she can move forward in peace. Or, you know, maybe she is so devoted to the law that this fine technical point has been giving her sleepless nights since January of this year, and she felt this urgent need to correct something, which again amounts to, in layman's terms, a distinction without a difference. I'm not in a position to judge what motivated her, but I think one thing we can agree on is that it was very unfortunate for her to go public, not only in the manner in which she did, but also in the forum in which she did. You know, she wasn't addressing either genocide scholars or specialists in international law, but a general audience, viewers of a BBC talk show, who would be much more prone, like you and I, to misunderstand some of these finer, minute details of international law than people who are specialized in the field. And it's particularly unfortunate because her statements come at a time in which, as you said, the consensus among genocide scholars and specialists in the international law of genocide is becoming more or less overwhelming, that Israel either is perpetrating genocide against the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip, or needs to be subjected to a very detailed and thorough examination because of its actions. Mm.
Of course, Donahue is not there anymore. And if you're a judge at the ICJ, you'd be looking at the systematic destruction of Gaza's health sector. Mm. And this week, there was a really fascinating report on that. There was a report by someone by the name of...
Maharaja.
And he produced a almost showing a mathematical certainty that the attack on Al Ahli Hospital on October 17 last year was caused by an Israeli strike. So that strike, as you viewers may recall, killed more than 400 Palestinians. But what was interesting was what Meher said, and I want to get your comments on that. Meher goes on to say that Meher has two PhDs, by the way. that it was a pilot test that the Israelis carried out to find out how the international community and the media would react. It does very much look like, you know, that the Israelis carried this out, and given that the indifference of the international community towards the destruction of Al-Ahli Hospital, they went on to completely decimate the health sector in Gaza. So yes, that's what Meher is saying, and it seems to be the case.
Yes, it's actually the second very detailed technical report that Maher Arrar has produced on this particular incident. I'm not qualified to assess the very considerable level of scientific evidence that he mobilizes. It seemed convincing to me, but it will be for others to assess. And unfortunately, Maher Arrar is inviting scrutiny, and he is inviting challenge, and he does want his assessment and conclusion to be out in the public arena. And people who should be interested in this, and people who should know better, have not given his reports the interest that they clearly deserve. What I will speak to is the political aspects of his conclusions, which to me seem exceptionally sound. Remember, this attack on Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital came very early during Israel's onslaught on the Gaza Strip. And as you mentioned, what Maher Arrar proposes as a theory, and he's not the first to do so, but it's significant that he does so in the context of the scientific evidence that he's mobilized, is that this attack was really a test case, and that Israel, as it does so often, pushes gently against an open door to see if there's going to be pushback from the other side. And if there isn't, it will push a bit further with a bit more force until it feels confident and comfortable enough to kick the door in and shoot up everything on the other side of it. And what happened here is that Israel attacked this hospital. It then engaged in a disinformation campaign whose purpose, in which it claimed that the real culprit here was an errant missile fired by either Hamas or Islamic Jihad. And as Maher Arrar notes, that's not a particularly credible explanation, because this single errant missile, we are to believe, killed multiple times more people than every other errant Palestinian missile has over the course of the past decade put together. But Israel's purpose, again, was not to convince, but rather to confuse, to spur people into ultimately a kind of passive neutrality, into looking at this as a he said, she said situation. And we're not there, so we don't know. And unfortunately, the mainstream press played an important role in promoting this theory, or at least the confusion that it was meant to sow. And I think even Human Rights Watch put out a report that lacked their typical standards of rigor and evidence. Now, there is one aspect that Maher Arrar, to the best of my recollection, did not address. And that is that Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital, to a much greater extent than any other hospital in the Gaza Strip, has important foreign connections. In this case, with the Church of England in the United Kingdom. And what others have proposed is that Israel attacked this hospital in the first instance, not despite its connections, but because of those connections. In other words, if it could satisfy itself that it could get away with a brazen attack on a church, a hospital that is essentially operated or supported by the Church of England, if it gets away with that, then every single hospital and clinic and other health facility and medical worker in the Gaza Strip is fair game, and it's open season, as you said, on the health sector. Maher Arar is far from the first to reach the conclusion that Israel was responsible for this attack. Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta, for example, who was actually at the hospital at the time of the attack, has consistently been enunciating a similar conclusion. Other doctors and journalists who were at the scene at the time have said the same. But I think the added value of his report, two reports actually, is that he mobilizes very detailed scientific evidence to substantiate his claims and conclusions. And I very much hope that people will assess these on the basis in which they've been formulated.
And it's also adding another organization, Forensic Architecture. They've also concluded that the attack was by Israeli plane and not Palestinians. And I think most of us who watched the footage instinctively knew that, you know, that the missile is Israeli missile. There is no way Palestinians possess this level of firepower to cause this level of destruction on anything. So,
yes. Sorry, I just interrupt you. I mean, not only that, but we're basically being asked to believe that every single attack, without exception, on a hospital or a health facility or medical staff in the Gaza Strip since October 7th has been perpetrated by Israel. But for some reason, you know, the attack that started it all off, or that came very early in the process, somehow had nothing to do with Israel, that it somehow wasn't part of the systematic pattern that we're all fully aware of.
Let's move on to President Biden's plan to construct a pier in Gaza. Of course, it's good news. The pier, one of the purpose of the pier is to distribute aid. And given there's a, of course, famine in Gaza, any avenue which increases the level of aid is to be welcome. But there is, of course, the concern that this plan essentially is a Netanyahu plan, and there is the possibility that this could be used not on the one hand, of course, to increase the level of aid that's being distributed, but also many people would say that, you know, this opens up the path to ethnically cleanse Palestinians using the pier to other parts of the Middle East and elsewhere. And ethnic cleansing has not been moved off the equation. Gaza is uninhabitable, you know, completely decimated. The health infrastructure, which we've spoken about a lot, has been completely destroyed. And ultimate goal has always been to ethnically cleanse. So, and if this is a Netanyahu plan through the means of the White House, then I think it'd be unwise to discount the fact that, yes, on the one hand, this is a positive news, but on the other, this could be the start of slow ethnic cleansing or depopulation of Palestinians from Gaza.
Yes, I think that's a very important point. And as you mentioned, forcible displacement, forced ethnic cleansing may be formally off the agenda, but voluntary ethnic cleansing is very much remains a policy option, if you will, part of the policy debate. And in a situation where the Gaza Strip from tip to toe has been deliberately made unfit for human habitation, this harbor could certainly be part of the demographic solution, so to speak, that Israel seeks and that its sponsors and allies have chosen not to oppose in a meaningful way, which means to make clear to Israel that there will be consequences for its actions. But I think there's a more immediate threat, if you will, attached to this pier. I mean, it is kind of surreal, you know, at a time when you have either existing famine in parts of the Gaza Strip or imminent famine in the rest of it. And the solution is literally hundreds of yards away and could begin by the time we end our conversation, and would require no more than a phone call from Washington to the Israeli government. The U.S. has chosen to build this pier. You know, perhaps Biden is nostalgic for the Normandy landings of 1944 or something, which won't be operational until next month, and which, even when fully operational, will not be able to meet the minimum requirements of the Gaza Strip. And so there's that aspect. And the more important issue, that once this pier becomes operational, it can serve as a fig leaf to permanently sever the land connections. And that's an issue that particularly concerns me, is that every time Israel is accused of preventing humanitarian aid, and every time the U.S. is accused of being complicit in this, they'll just point to this pier, say, look, we came all the way from Norfolk, Virginia, to build this thing to save these poor people. You know, so there's that aspect. And then there's a further aspect, which is that there are all kinds of reports that this will be done under an Israeli security umbrella. There's talk of British troops participating in the Gaza Strip, and it would directly implicate any humanitarian agency, any aid agency in the Israeli occupation and in Western complicity in Israel's genocidal assault. And so it puts the aid agencies in a very difficult corner, very difficult position. And just on that last point, we've already had, for example, a statement by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine that they will consider any presence of British troops in the Gaza Strip under these circumstances to be part of a belligerent occupation, and will treat them as such.
Yeah, which raises further concern, given apparently reportedly 1,000 U.S. troops are involved in the construction of this harbor. And if that is the case, all it takes is the unfortunate death of one U.S. soldier or British soldier, and then Israel can say, you know, the war is not just against the Israelis, it's against the British, it's against the Americans. We need to mount a much stronger military assault on Gaza. I mean, that's the narrative I think Israel is probably waiting for.
Yes, that would make perfect sense. And apparently, you know, Biden, Sunak, von der Leyen, and the others are perfectly happy to play along with this scenario. You know, their foreign policy principle is what Israel wants, Israel gets. What Israel doesn't want will not happen. That's kind of the rules of the game for them. And the idea that you're, you know, prepared not only to let Israel literally starve these people to death, but to help it starve these people to death while engaging in this pretty nonsensical idea of, you know, establishing an offshore pier that still needs to be properly constructed, you know, and by the time you start bringing in supplies, it will be much too late for many people. There will unfortunately be less mouths to feed. The damage will compound, and so on. It's really absurd. And I think it's also entirely appropriate to point a finger at the Arab League. And I believe it was in late November, the Arab League and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation adopted at a joint summit, adopted a resolution that they would immediately begin delivering humanitarian aid to the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. irrespective of the objections of Israel or anyone else. And they haven't lifted a finger. They live in collective terror of Washington and Tel Aviv.
Yeah, I want to pick up on something we spoke about last week, which is the arrest warrants that the ICC, the International Criminal Court, is apparently preparing against Netanyahu and Israeli officials. And I mean, the question many would be asking is, why haven't they just done it? Why haven't they announced that they are going after Benjamin Netanyahu? And it seems, you know, story from over the past week is that Biden and Western countries are fighting tooth and nail to prevent the imminent arrest warrants against Netanyahu. I know you have your doubts over the ICC generally issuing arrest warrants against Israeli officials. Do you think, you know, I mean, given the huge number of stories that are coming out from within Israel and also the US, that there is some hope that the ICC may actually be preparing arrest warrants now, and it's about time that it did so?
Yeah, you know, this is a very difficult question. And of course, bear in mind that my response to you is primarily based on speculation rather than any confirmed knowledge. But what we've seen so far is the Office of the Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court consistently drag its feet on its assessment of the situation in Palestine. In recent years, under the very poor and complacent leadership of the British prosecutor, Karim Khan. Now, all of a sudden, in the past week, we're seeing all these reports almost exclusively sourced to the Israeli press, indicating that Karim Khan is on the verge of indicting and or issuing arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, Israeli Defense Minister Gallant, Chief of Staff Halevi, and a bunch of others. I'm skeptical. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm skeptical for another reason. Some have suggested that these reports are actually being generated from within Israeli leadership circles. They have indications that that warrants may be imminent, and that when those warrants don't include their name, they can, you know, declare victory and claim that it was their own efforts and their own connections with Washington and Berlin and elsewhere that prevented the court from indicting them. This could also be a case where there are no indictments forthcoming, but these reports that they're imminent and then they fail to materialize can be shown by Netanyahu to demonstrate his connections and influence and so on in any upcoming Israeli elections. So again, we're speculating. My assumption has been that when the court does act, it will issue a whole series of indictments against Palestinian leaders, especially those associated with Hamas and Islamic Jihad. And it will balance this by issuing a number of warrants against the types of radical settlers who neither make policy nor take government decisions, you know, the types who are being partially blacklisted by the US, the UK, and the European Union. Now, it may well be the case that Khan has had an epiphany and realized that the court's legitimacy is very rapidly collapsing, and that if he just keeps focusing on the West's official enemies, like Russia, for its transgressions in Ukraine, and doesn't begin addressing issues that are of concern to the entire international community, like Israel's genocidal onslaught in the Gaza Strip, that there won't be much of an international criminal court left by the end of his tenure. I don't know. It's entirely possible. But as I've said, on this issue, I wouldn't hold my breath unless I was suicidal.
Yes, and one wonders why the ICC just doesn't announce something. If there's rumors all over the media, then why not say, you know, there hasn't been any plans to issue arrest warrants against Israeli officials, and kill the story? Why allow the speculation? And I think people are entitled in this kind of situation to be cynical and say, you know, what's at play here? And looking at the way the US has behaved and supported Israel in the manner it has done, especially with regards to protest, which we'll get to later on, the chances of the US undermining its own constitution and the interest of the US in order to protect Israel is way more likely than to see Biden allow the ICC to issue arrest warrants against Israeli officials. That to me is just a cynical position I take, but I agree with you. But
And just on that point, there's another curious aspect to the story, which are reports that supposedly the ICC prosecutor Khan is seeking U.S. permission to indict Israeli leadership figures. It doesn't strike me as particularly persuasive, because the idea that he would do so with and not understand that it was eventually going to leak, you know, and leak not only to Israeli journalists but also to Russian ones, which would thoroughly discredit any and all work he has done with respect to Ukraine, particularly because the United States is not even a party to the International Criminal Court, and has in fact passed legislation that allows U.S. military forces to invade the Netherlands in case any American official or official of allied countries, among whom Israel is explicitly named, are arrested. So I don't know. As you've mentioned, there's just too many question marks and loose ends in the story to make it persuasive. But again, I don't have any confirmed knowledge one way or the other. I can't categorically exclude the possibility that Khan has had a bout of professionalism and that we're all about to be pleasantly surprised in the next few weeks. But again, it's not my expectation.
And sticking with the White House, the U.S. State Department, as we predicted last week, it's put on hold its intention to impose a sanction on an Israeli battalion. This is a battalion known as the Netzer Yehuda, made up of extremist religious settlers. This is now the second time the White House or the State Department has done a U-turn after sanctioning first individual settlers, but now this time an entire battalion. And that's, to me, it's quite shocking, the fact that it cannot even go as far as to sanction what are religious extremists, in my point of view.
Well, you know, I was just reflecting back on our previous discussions where we've spoken about these various measures that the U.S. government has taken against a handful of individual settlers and now a single Israeli military battalion. And we spoke at length about the shortcomings of such measures and how they were really a diversion from the core issues at stake. And now, for the second time, it turns out that even these measures that gave the appearance of being primarily an exercise in smoke and mirrors, as you mentioned, even that's going too far for the United States, and particularly for Secretary of State Antony Blinken. We also had reports this week, that he's been, that he has received numerous reports from senior officials in his department, basically explaining that Israeli assurances with respect to international law or Israeli assurances that they actually investigate their own violations and crimes are simply not credible. But he, like his boss, Joe Biden, has this passionate attachment to the state of Israel, has blinders, is ideologically predisposed to a belief that Israel can do no wrong. And if it is seen to do wrong, that's because it's someone else's fault, invariably. He's simply constitutionally incapable of holding Israel responsible for anything. And I think he's literally allergic to the prospect of confronting Israel with consequences for any of its actions, even genocide. That's how extreme the situation is.
Turning our attention to the protests, I mean, that was the main news from last week. Scenes coming out of there quite horrific, in all honesty. US seems more like an authoritarian dictator in the Middle East or China or Russia and not what it claims to be. The pro-Israeli groups like the ADL, self-styled anti-racist organizations, they've denounced the protests as being Iranian proxies. You sent out a tweet, or you commented at length on X, putting the protesters within a historical context. So share that with us. You know, how should we view these protests now, and give us a historical context of how important the moment this is?
Yes. Well, first, let me just observe that not only do you have a situation where Biden is willingly prepared to lose this year's presidential election to Donald Trump and sacrifice it at the altar of not only Israel, but the altar of Benjamin Netanyahu. But we're now in a situation where civil liberties, the rule of law, and all these values that the United States and its elites claim to hold dear are instantaneously thrown out the window when it comes to Israel. In other words, we'd rather have a defense of Israel than our values and our freedoms. Regarding these protests, I think it's difficult to overestimate their significance. I describe them as a pivotal moment, and making the point that while college students are not an accurate reflection of public opinion or a faithful mirror of their society, they do serve as a bellwether. They do serve often as a sign of the shape of things to come, and that when you have college students and their activism and their movements reaching a critical mass, that's often an indication that significant change is coming further down the line. We saw that in the late 1960s and early 1970s with the Vietnam War. The anti-war movement was led in many cases by students and their uprisings on university campuses and so on. We saw that in the 1980s with the anti-apartheid movement, and ultimately the West's withdrawal of its support for that country's white minority regime. And just the idea that you would have dozens of encampments at US universities, from the Ivy League to state schools, from California to New York, in solidarity with the Palestinian people. This is something that would have been considered inconceivable even two decades ago. And it really, I think, demonstrates that Israel has lost the battle for public opinion, that Israel can no longer recover what is for Israel a very strategic asset, namely the support of Western public opinion. And its recognition of the significance of this defeat, I think, explains its hysterical reaction in the form of some of the examples that you just provided. Excuse me.
Yeah, I've been particularly surprised by the reaction, especially by the right-wing media and their narrative about the protest itself. People like Musk and others, this is Elon Musk I'm talking about, they portray these protests as the last stage in the decline of Western civilization. That's how they view this, and that's how they speak about it.
Comforting thought, but I don't think they're right.
And the idea that Gen Z represents the last stage in the collapse of Western civilization, and this is a reflection of that. Many, I think, would argue that that's not the case. The people who are undermining Western civilization are the politicians, are the businesses and the corporations, and the military-industrial complex. They're the ones who are supporting this genocide. They're the ones who are undermining the credibility of the West, and not Gen Z by protesting in the manner they have. But Musk in particular, I mean, this week he stirred a lot of controversy, partly because he has shown which side he's on. He's tweeted a number of times supporting Israel. In one particular tweet, he says that, you know, if you teach weak makes right, then the perceived stronger party, in this case Israel, is wrong. And then he goes on to argue that, you know, morality should be taught in absolute meaning. That is, absolutes, meaning that it's possible for someone who is weak or strong to be good or bad, depending on their actions. And to a lot of people, that's a straw man argument. No one has said that Israel is wrong because it's strong and Palestinians are right because they're weak. And so for someone in his position to be using his platform to service this genocide, I found shocking. I mean, you could find a number of cases where, you know, Israel is wrong in this case because it's against the principles and the values which are absolutely agreed upon by the international community. And that's what you would argue, I would assume.
Yeah, I mean, as someone observed, I unfortunately can't remember who, and give that individual credit for the statement that, you know, you can take Elon Musk out of apartheid South Africa, but you can't take apartheid South Africa out of Elon Musk. You know, he's now become a recognized crusader against anti-Semitism of all people. Elon Musk, really? It just shows how Israel and its flunkies have thoroughly trivialized and debased and rendered meaningless a term such as anti-Semitism, which no longer has any relationship to its proper definition, but has become instrumentalized instrument to defame people who criticize a foreign state and its policy. It's really that simple. And you know, you look at the attacks on these students who I should add, they have managed to demonstrate extraordinary discipline against extraordinary provocations and threats to their futures and so on. It's quite concerning how this may develop as Israel and its apologists becoming increasingly desperate and hysterical. But I have to say this, these students and their movement, genuinely inspirational for what they're doing. They're sitting at a significant historical juncture. So what are the lines of attack? First of all, these kids don't even know what they're doing. It's peer pressure. They haven't had enough sex. They've had too much COVID. They, you know, don't even know where Palestine is. They don't even know what they're demonstrating for. Okay, that fails. So then, well, it's because they know exactly what they're doing. Namely, they're all supporting Hamas. They're all terrorists. They're all anti-Semites. They're all Nazis. You know, the typical tactics of defame, demonize, vilify, discredit, and place people standing up for right and principle, place them beyond the pill. It's obscene. It's disgusting. And I think it speaks to such desperation that in this case, it's unlikely to work.
And to think that Biden could give the likes of Musk what they want, which is to crack down on these protesters with special police forces and undermine his own re-election. It's a possibility. I think he could send in the, not the troops, but, you know, the special police officers to carry out brutal attacks on the protesters.
I don't know how the various authorities work, especially where you have a university that's private property, and then you have, you know, city police forces and state national guardians. I really don't know how that works, but Biden has already performed the vital service of denouncing these students as anti-Semites. Why? Because they're opposing genocide. It seems he's determined to alienate every single principled voter within earshot. And again, people mock Biden for being old and senile and all the rest of it. My view is he knows exactly what he's doing. He's so invested in Israel and Zionism that he understands that it may cost him the election, but he considers it a price well worth paying. If he has to choose between, as many Democrats put it, the future of democracy in the United States or the future of apartheid in Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu, 10 out of 10 times he will choose for apartheid and Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yes, and on that bleak note, we have to end today's conversation. So thank you, Moin. That was my guest, Moin Rabbani. And thank you for tuning in. See you next week for another episode of The Memo Review with me, Naseem Ahmed.
Thank you, Naseem.